I'm Montse Alvarado. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, return to the Middle East. The U.S. Secretary of State meets with Israeli officials in the hopes of securing a ceasefire. The defense rests. New developments in Hunter Biden's gun trial in Delaware. Thirsting for more, an update on a recent movie that examines the power of Holy Communion. And some free advice. Pope Francis has a recommendation for those who feel enslaved by money or pleasure. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. I'm Montse Alvarado in for Tracy Sable. Our top story tonight. As war rages between Israel and Hamas, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken returns to the Middle East, trying to end the fighting. He told reporters his message to governments and people throughout the region is this. If you want a ceasefire, press Hamas to say yes. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen, great to see you.
Monse, for President Joe Biden's top diplomat, it's his eighth urgent diplomatic mission to the region since war broke out last October. Hanging in the balance tonight, that proposed ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Blinken once again calling on Hamas to accept the plan, which he says has international support.
In Cairo, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken meeting with the President of Egypt, a key mediator with Hamas in the ceasefire negotiations. And speaking to reporters near his plane, Secretary Blinken put the onus on the terror group.
Does Hamas want to end this conflict, end this war that it started, or not? We'll find out. But it's clear that virtually the entire world has come together in support of the proposal. And the only open question is, will Hamas say yes?
And now the world awaits an answer.
If you want to alleviate the terrible suffering of Palestinians in Gaza, press Hamas to say yes. If you want to get all the hostages home, press Hamas to say yes.
Over the weekend, a dramatic rescue of four Israeli hostages held in Gaza in a major military raid. The operation also resulted in the deaths of a large number of Palestinian civilians. And while President Joe Biden, Secretary Blinken, and other U.S. officials have praised the hostage rescue, it may complicate the ceasefire push by emboldening Israel and hardening Hamas's resolve to carry on fighting.
Innocent people were tragically killed in this operation. The exact number we don't know, but innocent people were killed, and that is heartbreaking. That is tragic.
But National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan blamed Hamas for placing hostages among civilians.
The president himself has said in recent days that the Palestinian people are going through sheer hell in this conflict because Hamas is operating in a way that puts them in the crossfire.
And today, the mother of one rescued hostage, overjoyed and grateful, but at the same time, remembering and pleading for the others still held captive.
But the remaining hostages need a deal to get home safely. There is a deal on the table.
Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, Blinken meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about that deal.
One more development to tell you about today. The UN Security Council approved its first resolution endorsing that ceasefire plan to end the war between Israel and Hamas. It was approved overwhelmingly, with only Russia abstaining, and it puts added pressure on Israel and Hamas to approve the proposal. Monse, back to you.
For more, let's bring in Israeli government spokesman David Mentzer. David, thank you for joining us. First, can you tell us how the four rescued hostages are doing?
Well, thank you very much for having me join you, Monse. The four are doing remarkably well. The Sheba Hospital near Tel Aviv is by now quite experienced at dealing with the trauma of these hostages. But these poor four people have been in custody in Hamas's terror clutches for 8 months now. The initial stages, say the doctors, is normally quite euphoric. They are obviously delighted to see their families, all of us here in Israel, and I think around the world cannot have helped to shed a tear to see those people reunited with their families after 8 months. There is that initial euphoria. They have been checked medically. The doctors have found them to be malnourished. But other than that, they are okay.
Absolutely. Well, we're praying for their speedy recovery. But I have to ask if you know anything more about the U.S. hostages that were taken.
Yes, of course, there are five live hostages that we know about with U.S. and Israeli citizenship. The government of Israel and the prime minister in particular has made an appeal for all governments, governments to put pressure on Hamas to release their hostages. And we're asking all of the governments, and the U.S., of course, is no different. U.S., of course, is our closest ally in the world, and we're working so closely together in the conduct of this war to defeat Hamas militarily and their governing capabilities to bring our hostages home and, of course, to make sure that Gaza never forms a threat to us here in Israel ever again. So, yes, we're trying to get all of our hostages back, of course. And I mean that. I mean all of our hostages back.
Well, we're grateful for that. There were reportedly 274 Palestinian civilians who died in that raid alone. And, of course, thousands since the war. What does the government say about the way that casualties are being treated in this war?
Well, Israel will always try its utmost to keep civilians out of harm's way. But I'll tell you one thing. You know, it is a particular kind of chutzpah to kidnap our people, to steal our people, to hide them away in dense civilian areas, used as slaves in a civilian home with a Hamas gunman, and then to complain about civilian casualties when we rescue them.
Now, Mr. Mensah, Secretary of State Antony Blinken returned to the Middle East today to meet up with top Israeli officials. What progress has been made on the Israeli proposed ceasefire deal?
Well, unfortunately, precious little progress, because time and time again, and the U.S. have confirmed this, Secretary Blinken, as well as Qatar and Egypt, they always say the same thing. It's Hamas every single time that walks away from a deal. And I tell you why they walk away. It's because they're emboldened by so many international players. They think to themselves, you know, why do we need to give back hostages if the international community is putting so much pressure on Israel?
Well, we'll keep watching this closely. Thank you so much, David.
Good to be with you.
No one is above the law. That is what a prosecutor told jurors during closing arguments in Hunter Biden's federal gun trial. Prosecutors tried to point to the, quote, overwhelming evidence against the president's son and called on jurors to pay no mind to the members of his family in the courtroom. The defense told the jury that the prosecution did not prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. The president's son has pleaded not guilty to three felony gun charges. The jury has now entered deliberations. Let's bring in criminal defense attorney and legal expert Tama Cudman. Let's begin with the trial of the president's son, Tama. The defense rested today. Hunter Biden did not testify. Was that the right decision?
So we never know what, you know, decisions the defense camp are making, because we don't know what we don't know, right? But there are a lot of reasons why you would not want a defendant to testify. And for the most part, the rule is, unless you have something that the defense can say that is unique, that hasn't been presented by other witnesses, you typically don't want a defendant to testify.
And what did you think of the case that was presented by the defense?
So again, it's very hard to Monday morning quarterback, right? But I think the defense did a very good job of showing that this was a very emotional time for the Biden family, particularly for Hunter Biden, that he was going through a lot of difficulties, that he was battling addiction. And when you're dealing with these ATF forms, they are somewhat confusing in terms of the language. And Mr. Biden had just gone through rehab. So the question is, was he using drugs? In his mind, he may have believed that he was now rehabilitated and he wasn't using drugs. And so by answering no, the defense would argue he was being truthful, because at that time he had gone through rehab and was fighting the addiction.
Well, let's switch gears. Former President Trump is being interviewed by New York probation officials today. It's a required step before his July sentencing and his criminal trial. Can you tell us, criminal case, forgive me, can you tell us a bit about that and what that will entail?
Sure. So probation is playing the role of advisor to the court. It's probation's job to find out background information about former President Trump. What was your childhood like? Are there any psychiatric issues here? Are there any cognitive issues? Are there lifestyle issues that might have played a part in the actions that he's now been convicted of a crime, you know, for engaging in, right? Probation has to tell the judge, who is President Trump as an individual?
Well, let's take a listen to what Trump said during his first post-trial rally in Arizona.
I just went through a rigged trial in New York with a highly conflicted, and I mean highly conflicted, judge, where there was no crime. It was made up, fabricated stuff. They didn't want to bring the case.
Could comments like that figure into his sentencing or even his probation?
Absolutely, they could, because it shows a disrespect for the law. It shows a lack of remorse. It shows a lack of recognition of what he might have done wrong. You know, the criminal justice system, one of the goals is rehabilitation. And when a person shows a lack of remorse and a lack of respect for the justice system, and remember, it's not just the system. 12 jurors have concluded that these charges were not only rightly brought, but that former President Trump was guilty of the allegations. And so the fact that he would go out in the public and be dismissive of the allegations and the conviction, disrespectful of the justice system, that is going to weigh on the judge.
Now, very quickly, Tama, he is the presumed Republican nominee. Could he need permission to travel?
Yes. So when a person is on probation, generally they have to stay within the territory or jurisdiction. And anytime a person wants to leave their jurisdiction, they would have to apply for leave to travel. Now, we have a unique situation here that we've never had before. We have the convicted individual happens to be the presumptive Republican candidate. And so he's going to need to travel, and the judge is going to be wary of the fact that, you know, the Republican voters have spoken. This is the person they want to be their candidate, and, you know, that he's got to respect the process and allow him to campaign to the extent that he needs to.
We'll leave it right there. Thank you so much, Tama.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to see you.
With the November election less than 5 months away, Speaker Mike Johnson says he's going after the justice system following the conviction of former President Donald Trump. House Republicans say the plan is to impose consequences on federal bureaucrats they believe have weaponized the government for political purposes. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales reports. Eric.
How you doing there, Monse? Well, Republicans are doubling down on their efforts to cut funding for the Justice Department and other agencies who they believe have targeted pro-lifers, Catholics, and even parents who spoke out against school boards, not to mention former President Donald Trump. House Speaker Mike Johnson says that they are close to coming up with a comprehensive three-pronged action plan to hold agencies accountable, and they want voters to know what they're doing.
We're looking at various approaches to what can be done here through the appropriations process, through the legislative process, through bills that we'll be advancing through our committees and putting on the floor for passage, and also through oversight. All those things will be happening vigorously.
Others say it's about time.
Speaker Johnson going after the DOJ. Your thoughts on that? I mean, just
they should
whole,
be going after the DOJ. I mean, there's a double standard that exists within the justice system, and hopefully with inherent contempt we'll see more to that action.
House Judiciary Committee Chair Congressman Jim Jordan fired off a letter to the Appropriations Committee wanting reforms made to the government funding process for next year, like cut funding for the FBI, and to eliminate federal funding for, quote, state prosecutors or state attorneys general involved in lawfare. Jordan also secured $4.5 million to ramp up investigations. Democrats claim Republicans have it wrong.
It appears to be weaponized against Democrats. They're prosecuting a Democratic House member in Texas, a Democratic senator in New Jersey, and the president's son. So that makes a very bizarre case for weaponization against the Republicans.
It's dangerous, and it undermines the rule of law, and it undermines our democracy.
Can Congress do anything more than just take away funds?
That's one of them, but we can look at, and we talked about this morning, setting up a special commission, authorizing them.
Congressman Norman says Republicans will hear more about the plan this week, but some GOP lawmakers have their doubts anything will change.
What we got to do is cut their money off. That's the only thing that we can do, but we don't have the guts to do anything. We'll just cover them up with letters and anger, and it won't do a dadgum thing, and America's ticked off about it, and I'm ticked off about it.
Now, Democrats I spoke with tell me that this is all just smoke and mirrors, something to calm their base. Now, Republicans did fire back, saying, watch them work. And by the way, this week, the House will also vote to hold Attorney General Merrick Garland in contempt for his refusal to turn over audio recordings of interviews with President Biden conducted by special counsel Robert Hur and his team. I'll stay on top of that story. Monty?
Thank you so much, Eric. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, including sounding the alarm, why a church leader in Australia says there are religious freedom violations taking place in his country, and the European Union Parliament elections send shockwaves through Europe and the rest of the world. We have analysis. The Archbishop of Sydney, Australia, is speaking out on religious concerns in his country. Archbishop Anthony Fisher says several new laws are hostile to religion. He pointed to concerns such as targeting of silent prayer in public and a forced takeover of a Catholic-run hospital. He also says the situation is serious enough that the faithful should be prepared to be, quote, saints for our time. Church leaders in Scotland are reacting to new data saying that the majority of people in the country have no religion. Recently released census results found more than 51% of respondents claimed they have, quote, no religion. In 2011, only 37% of respondents made the same claim. In a statement to EWTN's Catholic News Agency, the Catholic Church in Scotland said the loss of faith is not surprising, given the country's economic hardship, major wars in the world, and the lingering impact on church attendance from the COVID pandemic. A four-day election in the European Union Parliament has delivered a shock to ruling parties. In France, the results from a right-wing party has forced a national election in just 3 weeks. And in Italy, the party of Giorgia Meloni won more than a quarter of the national vote. The total likely would make her party a key player in any future alliances. The pro-European party still hold the majority in the 27-nation assembly. For analysis, we turn to Professor Timothy Helwig from the Department of Political Science at the University of Buffalo. Dr. Helwig, thank you so much for joining us. First off, were these results a surprise? And what, if anything, does this mean on a practical level?
It's good to be with you, Monse. They were surprising at the margins, I think, right? On the one hand, what it speaks to me is that these are really, 27 separate elections. It's not one election in one country, but as we were expected, we did see a fairly strong support by the far right parties. But if anything is surprising to me, it's really that the center held, right? And so I expect that Europe will be able to retain its unity going forward, and has met this challenge that many people feared. Now, the results within different countries, you mentioned Spain, you mentioned France, you mentioned Italy, are another matter all entirely. But overall, I think it's been a positive outcome for those who are behind the European project of unification.
Well, let's talk a little bit about France specifically. After the results over the weekend, France President Emmanuel Macron called a snap election to take place in 3 weeks. Can you tell us more about his decision and why he wants the election to happen so soon?
Yeah, this is the real surprising part if you start tracking in within countries like this. I think Macron really sent out this bombshell. I think he wants it to happen so soon to see if there's any way that he can have this Hail Mary pass, as it were, try to stave off dwindling support within his country. It was not surprising that the national rally, the far right party, did so well in France, but it more than doubled the support in the election for Renaissance, for Macron's party group. So I think Macron sees himself that if he doesn't take drastic steps like calling an election, it's going to be a very difficult remaining of his presidency through 2027. So I think he's just trying to sort of take this big gamble, put it before the electorate, and do it relatively quickly in order to hope that France sort of, as it were, wakes up and tries to, as he thinks, comes back to its senses and supports a more centrist option rather than giving more support to the far right party.
Well, then let's look at what this could, what kind of an effect this could have on the U.S. or the U.K. Could these results signal anything that might happen in elections in November or on the July 4th elections in the U.K.?
Yes, that's I think it could, right? In the sense that what's really interesting here is that you have sort of what political scientists call a second order election, which is the European Parliament election, kind of showing that it matters for the first order, the most important elections within these European countries. So I think for the UK, we're going to see maybe this will give rise to some more, I would say, anti-Europe elements or anti-migrant elements within British politics, though I still think that Labour Party will do relatively well with its centrist candidate for Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. And in the United States, if anything, this may increase the increase views of what might be possible in the American election. I think the American election already seems very knife edge and razor thin, go either way. But the European context just shows you anything can happen in politics. I guess the lesson for me is that you really have to think about, just as this European election was many different elections in different countries with local politics, we see a similar parallel in the United States, right, when we talk about key election battlegrounds rather than really a single national vote.
Well, we'll be watching those key elections and battlegrounds here on EWTN. Thank you so much, Dr. Helwig.
Great to be with you.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a host of good reviews. A new movie about the power of the Eucharist breaks records during its limited release. Plus, the Holy Father offers some advice to those who feel enslaved by money, power, or pleasure. The National Eucharistic Pilgrimage arrived at the nation's capital this weekend. During Sunday's Mass at the Basilica, Cardinal Wilton Gregory reminded pilgrims about the importance of the Eucharist in our daily lives.
In this sacrament, God Himself comes close to each one who receives this gift. The Eucharist is God's offering of His hand in a sacramental way, in order to draw us close to Him.
More than 1,000 people attended, both pilgrims and supporters. This is the St. Elizabeth Ann Seton route, which originated in New Haven, Connecticut. And for more, you can go to EWTN News In Depth, which will have coverage, full coverage, this Friday at 8 p.m. A new movie about the power of the Eucharist is the second highest grossing documentary film of the year. Jesus Thirst grossed more than $2.1 million during its three-day run. Due to the performance, organizers have added additional days later this month where it will be shown in theaters. Executive producer Deacon Steve Greco calls on those who have seen the movie to be Eucharistic evangelists and to encourage others to see it June 18th and 19th. As Rome gears up to host the 2025 Jubilee, Pope Francis paid a visit to the city's mayor and administration. In his remarks, the Holy Father encouraged lawmakers to see the preparations as an opportunity for development and not a burden. EWTN Vatican correspondent Colin Flynn has more.
A very good evening, Monse. This morning, Pope Francis left the Vatican, crossed the Tiber River, and visited Rome's Capitoline Assembly, the city's administration center. The Pope went there to meet with the mayor of Rome, Roberto Guantieri, and his staff to discuss the upcoming Jubilee year of 2025. The Pope said he was grateful for all the work that was being done by the city in preparation to welcome all the pilgrims and reminded them that Rome was a city of welcomes with a spirit of hospitality. but he asked the officials to use their power to extend that welcome to everyone, not just the tourists and the pilgrims, but to the poor, to the sick, to the imprisoned, and to the excluded. The Pope praised the officials for giving many parts of the inner city a makeover and improving things like public transport. But he also said this should be an opportunity to foster a relationship between the centre and the peripheries. Speaking in the Hall of the Flags overlooking the Roman Forum, the Pope highlighted the incredible history of the city and said that it had been a beacon of light for so many people over the centuries. He referenced ancient Roman culture, saying it had many good values, but at the same time also needed to constantly evaluate itself to find deeper, quote, fraternity, love, hope, and liberation. The Pope reflected on how the spread of Christianity within the Roman society offered people new hope and challenged pre-existing social norms that were deemed acceptable, like, for example, slavery. He said that, quote, the immense cultural and historical wealth of Rome was both a privilege and a responsibility for its citizens and leaders. As Pope Francis ended his visit, he made a very special and unique announcement. Holy doors are a strong symbol of the Jubilee year, and they're normally reserved for the city's papal basilicas. They're meant to have a redemptive quality. Pilgrims receive an indulgence as they pass through these doors. Yet this year, Pope Francis wanted to make sure those on the margins were included. And to do that, the Pope said a holy door would be placed in one of Rome's prisons during the year of Jubilee. In Rome, Colm Flynn, EWTN News Nightly.
And finally tonight, Pope Francis reminds the faithful that we can either be imprisoned by greed and sin or free like Jesus.
Soffermiamoci un po' a contemplare questa libertà di Gesù.
During his Sunday address at the Vatican, the Holy Father says it's easy to fall into a sort of slavery by worshiping money, power, and pleasure. Instead, we can approach God and ask him to take away everything that weighs us down. Doing so will enable us to help those around us without limits. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Montse Alvarado. Good night, and God bless.